Welcome to Art with
Fiona Verity.
Say it again.
Fiona?
No.
Fiona Verity.
And Julie Nicholson.
Oh.
How did you and Joe meet? Oh.
Well, hang on. We've only got one. Hang on. What? So...
This is going to not end.
So we are with Joe Mellor and Natalie O'Connor, and they are having a show coming up at Woollahra Red Leaf Gallery. I'm going to hand it over to you ladies to tell us how you two met and came together to do the show, and then we will interview you both about your practices.
Sounds good.
Okay. So Joe and I have worked alongside each other for probably 3 to 4 years, it would have been. Mm-hmm. We knew each other's work really, really well because we saw it grow over that period, but we never met.
At UNSW, right?
Yeah. We met each other many years later at Hazelhurst when you were putting an exhibition in Broadhurst. So I never even when she said she was coming to the gallery to install that exhibition, I didn't know what she looked like.
It was a bit Banksy. Was this a bit of a Banksy thing that you didn't think each other existed? Or you were invisible?
And many people thought that I had taken over, or Joe had taken over, the whole studio bay, because we had allocated areas, because our work really sang together, didn't it?
You were both studying there?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We were Bay 13.
Unlucky for some.
That could have been the name of the show.
That could have been a good
Bay 13.
Bay 13.
That's the next one.
Yeah.
But you were the same bay, but you never met each other?
No.
No, never. Never.
Was it a big bay? I'm thinking
it was tiny. That big. Like literally, if we were in there together, our bums would touch if we were working.
That's very normal, though, to have a studio space that you share at uni and you don't cross.
Oh.
So there were four of us in Bay 13.
You're not thinking of a beach.
No. I've got the bay concept. Oh. I just wondered how you wouldn't have met.
Because I was working in a role where I was coming and going all the time. And so I would come in at nights or on the weekends.
And come in during the week.
Did you leave each other notes?
Yes.
Oh, I love it.
Occasionally we did.
Oh, I love it. Like, I'm liking this one.
Mm, yeah.
Like that top right area is awesome.
You've left your Vegemite sandwich on the seat.
Exactly.
Don't do it again.
Please don't put your coffee cup in the bin.
Yeah.
So how did this... Have you exhibited together before?
No.
So how did this one come about?
This came about actually... Funny story. Another artist asked me to exhibit with her, and I just thought that perhaps we would be better as three or four artists together. And I thought of Natalie's work and the idea that we both work on place and we work on country within similar sort of areas, I guess. Would you say Mungo, Menindee, Broken Hill? It's all the same area, northwest New South Wales. So I invited Natalie to join us. I just thought, wow, you know, she's doing some really interesting stuff with some glass cylinders and some paints, and would love to meet her as well. And then we had another artist called Lux.
Yeah,
Lux join us as well. We applied for an exhibition at Woollahra, and it got rejected, and so we left it at that.
Oh dear, was that Natalie's fault?
No, I blame Lux.
Well, obviously not, because they rang us up.
Why did they reject
it? Natalie rang last year and said, look, we'd love you, you know, we've had a look at your, you know,
Proposal,
thank you.
Natalie didn't do that.
No.
Not Natalie. Pippa.
I was going to say, did that. Are you talking about Natalie in the third person there, Natalie? Pippa. Yes.
Pippa Mott from Pippa Mott. Who's the director,
We love Pippa.
Yes. Well, Pippa was trying to get a hold of me and couldn't, and then got a hold of you.
Yes. So she said, look, I can see that Natalie and your work resonate really well, and would you be interested in, you know, having an exhibition The only thing is we can't have four of you because I've already booked out two other places. So, yeah, that was
perfect.
A bit difficult. But
well, it's a project that will happen in the future.
Exactly, exactly, yeah. With the four of us.
Okay, so this one's you two with another two artists that are exhibiting separately.
Yes.
Yes, yes. Exactly. Yeah. Cool. Because they normally have four. Well, no, yep. they have more, don't they?
But and we're four rooms. We'll put it in the show notes, but it's running from the 20th of March to the 14th of April.
That's correct.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll put a little link in too.
Yeah. So even though you're both working on country and... Just eat that chocolate cake that Joe's provided. I'm so sorry.
It's a bit of texture.
Cake comes first. So you're both working on country, but obviously your work is different. So, Joe, your latest exhibition at Willara is going to be called Cobalt and Rust. Mm-hmm. You primarily work in textiles, and you've explored the land around Broken Hill, the degradation due to climate change and mismanagement of the land, plus advocating for Aboriginal collaborative relationships.
Oh, that was a mouthful.
I was with the chocolate cake in. I'm so sorry. So we've got a good idea of what you're going to be showing, but can you tell us more about how you came to this body of work?
That's a great question. So I started going out to Broken Hill in 2015, actually through one of the UNSW courses with Peter Sharp. And so he introduced me and a group of other students to an amazing area called Fowler's Gap. And with it came, you know, a tour of Broken Hill. And I became really fascinated with, you know, the area. It wasn't anything that I'd experienced before. It was amazing. But, the one thing that I sort of realised about Broken Hill was the idea that, everything was broken, everything was rusting, you know, there was these massive shafts everywhere and mine sort of holes, you know, in the ground everywhere. And I just thought, wow, this is just such an opportunity to present, you know, the area and, you know, how I perceive it. And I just, so that work sort of moved into my honours year at UNSW as part of the Bachelor of Fine Arts degree. And I honestly wanted to get as far away as I could from Sydney and to understand that sort of Broken Hill area again. And, you know, the idea that everything was so broken out there because, you know, we're looking at, you know, exporting minerals and all this sort of stuff.
Why is it called Broken Hill?
It's called Broken Hill because there was a guy called Rasp who I think in the early 1800s was out there and came across this ridge that happened to be, you know, shiny in the sun, and it was actually some minerals that were exposed, and, you know, it was showing broken crevices in the ground and I guess it was on a hill as well, and, the town was born.
Oh, wow. And it's called the Silver City.
The Silver City.
That's the mineral that they get.
They find lots of minerals
lots
out
of
there.
Lots of minerals.
Every street is a different mineral, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. So I became really invested in the area, and so that was my honours year, and I started to think, gosh, how can I sort of perceive this place? And painting wasn't really cutting it, so I started to work with textiles, which I'd never done before, and I started to take lots of photographs of the area out there, and in particular the detail of the rust that I found out there. Everything seemed to be rusting. And so those photographs that I took were transposed onto I used them in Photoshop, and then they were printed as patterns onto fabric, and then after they're printed I would sew into them. And the idea of sewing came across, you know, from my mother years and years ago, where she would repair my clothes and, you know, and somehow give it care and, you know, and repair the things. And so I just thought that was a really interesting way of looking at the idea of care and repair of you know, of country and how we can, you know, perceive it in that way. So that sort of started. And then I moved into a master's, and the idea of using textiles again was, you know, something that I, you know, had started to really experiment with. But there was always something missing, which was the fact that, you know, I just thought that I should be really talking to someone about, you know, about this place, and who better than, you know, our who better than, you know, the Aboriginal community out there. And so with that, one of my supervisors, so I had two supervisors. One was Bianca Hester, an amazing artist in her own right, and Fabri Blacklock, who also works in textiles. And she knew an Aboriginal elder who worked, because I wanted to sort of do a lot of work with water at that stage and water mismanagement that was going through with the Darling River. And so she knew an Aboriginal elder who I could actually have a chat and speak to, and, you know, and an amazing relationship was born out of that. And it made me realise that, you know, it's a place where I think artists who do work on place or, you know, anywhere really, should really address the fact that we should be talking to, you know,
well, the original custodians of the land.
Correct, correct. Yeah.
Because, you know, this it is their land.
It is their land.
Yeah, and there are so many stories to hear.
Absolutely. And the other thing is, she said, look, I'm so, I always felt like saying, you know, have you got time? Do you have time? She said, I have all the time in the world for you. And she said, I wish, you know, more people would come and have a chat with me about, you know, this amazing country so I can tell them what's going on.
Yeah. Do they feel like it's broken and needs to be, obviously it needs to be cared for, but like, do they respond to your work? Did she respond to your work because you were coming it from that angle?
Yes, she really did respond to the idea of textiles. And look, I wasn't just doing the work that you probably see here, which is just stitching into fabrics. I was, you know, wrapping trees, you know, with fabrics. But
you had things in bottles as well.
You know, all that sort of stuff. But the interesting thing was that I asked for permission to actually do this. And I think it's really important as artists to actually, you know, to do this, because I just think that they know so much more.
Well, definitely. Auntie, we've had this discussion before, Julie and I, about how if you're not from a place, obviously Julie and I are both British and we've lived here for over 20 years, but I, you know, I have Australian children. I'm now an Australian citizen. But I still am very British and have a foot in both camps now. And I think that whole identification with place is such a tricky one with being...
Yeah, like, you know, how long do you have to be in a place before you can identify with it or create work about it?
So it's very hard when you're not living for a long, long time, I think. And it's so important to do research and talk to people from a place, you know, that... then you can bring that into the work.
Because when you say on place, like, what do you mean by that?
Yeah.
Do you want to say? Because you've got a better explanation.
Don't know if it's better, but...
A different.
How would you describe place, Natalie?
I said place for me, and I had to really think about the way I was terming... Like, I didn't want to use the word land when I was writing about it. Place seemed a little bit more...
This is also really handy because I'm doing a project on place at NASS.
Write it down.
I don't know if I'm going to articulate it the best way today, but I suppose the way that I saw it was that there were these conventions around using the word on country that wasn't my term I could use.
Yeah.
And I'd had many conversations with artists who had worked in lots of regional areas, and this was something that, you know, we'd had conversations about, you know, what do you actually use the word? And when I've been working out in Mungo, we were using the word lake bed. So I'd use that with another group of artists, women artists, one of which was an Aboriginal woman. So we really talked about that idea as a collective. But place is a generic term. So it started to not only reference who we are in Australia, but that could resonate with people all around the world. Yep. I also had this sense of that my father had come from another country, my mother had come, well, she didn't, but her ancestors come from another country, so I'm Greek Australian. Yep. And so I grew up with a sense of wanting to feel like I belong to a place. And so I've gone back to those places and tried to find who I am or who I have become from being in this place. And I didn't feel like I had a sense of what it was in Australia, and I didn't feel like my research had a place. And so it wasn't until I went out to Mungo, and there was a certain process that I went to go through that, and that sort of, I suppose that's highlighted by the way what you were talking about in terms of permissions, but that's a, we'll get to that at a later stage. But in terms of place, the conversations that I had out there was about when you are at a place, your DNA is left behind. Yeah. So you are that. You are the story of that place. So the way in which you engage with that place, you have to be really respectful of you at that moment and where you are positioned. So it was really at the forefront of my thinking of what does it mean, me being out here, that I couldn't just go out and be like any other landscape painter that had gone out and decided that they were going to reference the landscape. I had to have a different dialogue, because this is me sitting here thinking, what is this place? Who has come before me? How do I recognise and acknowledge all that's come before, but also be mindful of what does this mean, my interaction in the future? Because whatever I do is going to have a ramification. And the steps I tread, you know, that conversation that's often said about treading softly and gently out there, especially out at Mungo, where everything under your feet crinkles and crisps. And, you know, you're treading on fossils that are, you know, tens of thousands of years old. And you become very aware of where you are placed, that you are extremely insignificant and yet vital to the whole positioning of the story.
Yes. So place, in a nutshell, is respect to the present, the past, the future.
It's time.
Yeah, the time. Well, that's a good explanation, Natalie. Thank you. Joe, back to your work. So how did you work out there with your textiles? Were you doing the piece?
I'm curious. Can I interrupt?
Yeah, go on.
You're calling it textiles, because we have this discussion a lot at National Art School about how a painting doesn't need paint. So these would be called paintings at NAS.
Interesting.
And interesting that you call them textiles.
Well, it's
is that a conscious decision because of the mending?
That's an interesting question. In my thesis, it's called an expanded textile practice, which covers the installations that I do. Yes. I've done a video. I do textiles. I do a bit of painting as well.
I see them as paintings.
Yeah. So it's a whole menagerie of different
things.
You're
not bothered. Basically.
No.
I love that.
No.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter, does it?
And it goes to country. I mean, I actually, talking about place and country, I actually asked Auntie at the time, can I use the word country? And she said, yeah, sure, fine. So I just guess it's
I think permission is so important.
Permission, exactly.
And you can never ask too many times.
Absolutely. But you have to be prepared when there's a no to accept the no.
Yes, true. I agree.
That's true. Yeah. Yes.
Absolutely.
So Auntie Beryl was quite integral to your project either. And this was for your master's?
This was for my master's.
And you did a research master's?
Correct, yes.
And the research was the mending and caring through textile work of Broken Hill?
of Menindee, which is 110 k's away from Broken Hill. So I just thought there was a lot going on 110 k's away. I happened to, you know, after the Peter Sharp trip one year, I actually drove all the way to Menindee, and you know, that they were in the middle of drought.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen the, you know, the whole of the Darling River.
It was horrendous.
Was that when all the fish died?
It was shocking.
The Darling Basin or
Murray Darling Basin.
It's such a epic space, mm-hmm. and I think it is the sort of the lungs of that area, and it's like the canary in the mine, isn't it? So when you see that going, it's the breaking down of the whole space.
Absolutely.
And it must have just
been. Do you think the management of that area is changing better for the better?
I think conversations have started, but when
El Nino helped, didn't
it? El Nino helped. And of course, they had flooding. Yeah. They had flooding last year with another fish kill event where, you know, there was just too much water. And the, you know, I happened to be there where there was so many dead fish around. And, you know, when you hear things from Auntie, I mean, I just listen so much. It's called deep listening. When you listen, you just get caught up in her story, and you just want to sit down and listen for a very long time. She's got many amazing stories. But when she says that, you know, her mother's totem is the Murray codfish, and she starts to, you know, get really upset, that's when you think, wow, you know, this is just not, you know, millions of fish. This is just a community. This is people who, you know, just don't have a say. From time and time again, the community don't have a say, and it's what the government wants and how they sort of manage, you know, the idea of water moving through, you know, agricultural areas. There's, you know, there's a lot of water licenses that are given to anybody, and anyone can collect that water to use whatever they want with. And, you know, there's a lot of
whitewashing
of the whole problem. Yeah. And don't worry, she'll be right for the next time. But it won't be right. So,
and do you think through your beautiful artworks, engaging with people, getting them to ask questions of them, brings attention to these things in a positive way? Because I see art as having that purpose. You know, it's a political thing, but it's not shouting. It's gently,
absolutely,
having those conversations.
Yeah, so that's such a great question again, because part of my master's was to not only have these conversations with Auntie, but also I just thought, what better way would be to invite 4 or 5 artists from Sydney to come with me and have these conversations with Auntie as well. And yarning circles, we create, you know, installations together, we have long conversations, we have cups of tea, you know, we sit in her garden and we just listen. And with that, you know, those artists come back to Sydney and they've made artworks that, it's almost like Chinese whispers, they've made artworks about that place, about that country, and that they've created conversations with their children or with other artists. So I just think it's a way of, you know, creating
attention,
in not a shouty way, but in a very sort of, you know.
So how is your artworks, can you describe your artworks that you've got in the exhibition, that how they relate to this project? And, like, how are you showing, like, I can see that they relate to a cracked river. I can see the colours of that earth in them. Like, and also, how do you make them?
I want to know how you get those colours.
Where do you start?
So, you know,
you don't have to give away all your tips and tricks. Keep some cards to your chest.
Keep some cards to your chest. Okay. So the exhibition's called Cobalt and Rust.
Yeah.
So I have, again, centred some artworks on Broken Hill. I've gone back to Broken Hill, which is amazing. I keep going back to Broken Hill as well. And I've had long conversations with Auntie Beryl about that area as well. And if you think about it, it's not just one town, another town. It's the whole area that is abused. And there's no permission to do all this stuff that we just take for granted, like mining or fishing or whatever it is, or agriculture. So again, I'm back in with Cobalt and Rust. I'm back in Broken Hill, and Cobalt and Rust, the title comes from there is a big mine that has been there for a little while now called the Cobalt Mine Project, and they mine cobalt. When they mine cobalt, it's sort of like this sort of greyish sort of material, and it's used for batteries and a whole list of energy giving things, cars. So
they're not going to shut that down anytime soon then.
No, exactly. So it's all obviously, with that blue that I've infused into the, my textiles, I have used Photoshop to help me sort of render that colour, because when I take what I do is I take photographs of different parts, different areas of Broken Hill, and then I those photographs are put in through a Photoshop program, and the blues, which are originally quite grey in colour, I make blue to represent the blue of the Cobalt Mine Project.
And then you print them on fabric?
Print them on fabric, and I try and go with a sustainable linen. I've been using these particular printers in Marrickville for a really long time, so they know my artwork and they know just the right sort of tone to use when I'm trying to get it printed. It's a sublimation program that they use to get those beautiful colours. And, and then I use cotton threads, metallic threads and fluoro threads sometimes to embroider and hand sew various lines, track lines into the linens and cottons. So it's a really close-up view of rust. Really?
Yeah.
It's mining detritus that's left around that cobalt mine.
Isn't that funny? Because I take them as like really quite expanded views of like when you're looking from a plane.
Yes.
Overseas. But that's funny that you've gone macro.
Yes.
So your idea was macro, and I see them as
micro.
Sorry, the other way around. Yeah.
And a lot of people say that about my work. It's very macro, micro. Yeah. What's going on? I mean, I've had doctors come in and say, well, they look like cells to me.
Yeah.
And veins.
And veins.
And it really is the cracking of the earth.
Yeah.
But isn't rust beautiful?
It is beautiful.
Love rust. I collect rusty things all the time.
Oh, do you?
Look at that little. I've got a bottle top in my bag.
So you can appreciate.
To see an old bottle top that's been on the road in Darlinghurst.
It's like an old Roman coin.
Oh, I know.
You're not lacking an iron, are you?
No.
And I'd be asking, what colour will it take?
I will ask you soon. I want an exact match, please.
Okay, so the ones in the exhibition, once you've stitched on them, then you stretch them like a painting?
Correct. Or a lot of them here, you can see, they'll be on
rods.
Hangers.
Yes, rods. Okay.
Yeah, so they'll be stretched on hanger rods and they'll be... that way.
So there's an element of printmaking. There's everything in there.
Yeah. It's printmaking, painting, sewing. Yeah. But I love the fact that you guys have picked up the micro macro look, because it is an aerial view, but it's close, and it's the way you look at the land.
Which is very. Do you think that's a very Australian way of looking, in the sense of an Indigenous First Nations way, that there's an ability to see the greater and the closeness?
I hope I'm not like that. Do you know what I'm
don't know if
say?
We can position ourselves like that, but I definitely I definitely had a sense of place because I was in a job that where I was flying above the land all the time, so the way I would see colour would be different. Mm. But when I see your works, because I had been in those same areas, to me it was like looking under the microscope, but also being, I could see both of those things at the same time. Well, and you, I think and that you can't also, help but be that.
That's right, absolutely, Natalie. But also you had the privilege to watch them grow over time.
Yes.
So you would see...
I would see the underside. Like, yes. I saw them before they were textiles. Yeah. I actually didn't see, I don't think, any of the textile stuff, or well, very few...
Oh, because I was experimenting with...
Yeah, there was lots of red thread.
Red thread and...
well, Natalie's got those red...
Loves the red.
There was, wasn't there?
Yes, there was. A lot of red thread and... Oh, it's interesting. And dyes, I create dyes from sort of some of the bark that I had.
There's a lot of manky stuff on your
stuff,
table.
Yeah. A lot of manky really stuff. A lot of rusty bits.
Yes.
Yeah. Lots of rusty... Screws and stuff.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy that part of the process, like making dyes and colours and?
Yes.
I could go off on one for years. I think making that would be a marvellous thing to do.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know,
Bay 13 was like a little science lab, wasn't it?
Well, I do see both your practices as being very scientific.
Yeah, they have got that element to it, but. Just going back, like what were you painting when before you started? Because obviously textiles was a real right turn and you've gone down that path quite specifically. Like what were you painting when you first...
Traditional paintings.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oil paint?
Oil, acrylic. I'd try watercolours, but look, it just felt very...
the right place for you.
It didn't feel right for me, and I didn't feel like that was me when I was trying to sort of convey this.
It wasn't your voice.
It wasn't my voice.
You were someone else.
It felt like someone else's voice that had been going on. You know, a lot of people have painted that area. You know?
Anyway, well, thank you, Jo. We look forward to seeing your exhibition. Yes. It sounds wonderful. And... over to Natalie and what your work is about for what I don't know what your exhibition what have you called your part of the exhibition
the red. Nature of redness
That's right,
it had to have red in there. I love it. So Natalie, you've done a lot.
Obsessive compulsive.
Yes. Your CV is epic. I was literally scrolling going, oh my goodness.
That's because I'm old.
No, I'm Natalie, I'm old and I've done a little bit, but my goodness. So exciting, all the different hats that you've had on. You know, you have really been a lot of places, experienced a lot of different things, teaching, working with great companies like Winsor & Newton, going out to Fowler's Gap and working on the No Way Home.
Not the Way Home.
I always say No Way Home. I always get confused with Ewan McLeod's... Not Ewan McLeod.
Oh, my God.
What's his name? Ewan...
McGregor.
When he did the Not... Long Way Down. See?
It's got nothing to do with it.
Yes, it does. Anyway, I'll scrap that bit. Jesus. Stop it. So... your current practice is exploring the materiality, behaviour and history of red. Is that right, would you say? Or
well,
is
it's
this
actually
your
colour, but red was the way in which I was able to bring that conversation to light.
Okay. So you have it's not just red, it's the whole spectrum.
Well, if by going and investigating red so intensely, like going down the rabbit hole with it, it would allow me to see other pigments and how they would behave as well. Because the same things that I were looking at in terms of the characters of the redness would be evident in yellow or blue or whatever other pigments.
Red doesn't live without the other colours.
Mm. Yeah. Unless
you have to have them in relation to other things.
And what it was basically, you know, like if somebody says, oh, you know, when it's red, in our minds we've got this idea of what red is.
Yeah, and fire engines and post boxes.
So I just recently said to the people that I'd invited to the exhibition, now I hope that you're wearing something red on the evening. And I got a few text messages back that said, oh, I don't have anything ready in my wardrobe. And I said, what rot? Of course you do. You would have something that would be like scarlet, like I'm trying to use words like oranges and stuff like that. Or you might have something that's rusty and brown,
yeah,
like, or pink. You know, who doesn't have something that's pink in their wardrobe? You know, like... So it's not
tomato red is what I would imagine people go to.
Yeah, like that fire engine red. That sort of, yeah. So, but it wasn't... It's not about the look of the red. It's about the feel and it's about the tactility. And the way that I've talked about materiality is that, you know, for colour or for painters, we're looking at the touch and the feel, not just what it looks like. If I was, and I suppose I'll just say it in a snapshot, it's many people get confused between dyes and pigments, and painters are working with pigments, hopefully.
Yeah.
And when you're using professional colours, you would be working with pigments. And those pigments are solid particles that are bound with a vehicle, which might be either acrylic, an oil, or gum arabic if it was watercolour. So yeah, that's essentially what, you know, I did in my work life with Winsor & Newton, is explain that to people, is that that's what they were working with. And I soon came to understand that even though I said that, they were just words.
Yeah.
People couldn't see and feel it when they were working with their paint. They still slapped it on really thick. They still added white into every one of their colours. And they lost the sense of the integrity of that raw pigment in the first place. So I thought the only way that I could show that or investigate the redness was to completely deconstruct the colour itself. And so the installations or the way in which I work, because whether they're in a gallery or whether they're sitting in my studio, I just keep building them all the time. And they were happening even in the studio during COVID as well, is I take watercolour, because water is kind of what I call naked paint or naked pigments. And then it's that gum arabic doesn't really play around with it too much. You see the truth of the behaviour of the pigment. And I heavily dilute that so that the remnants of those particles attach themselves to the paper. And by doing that, you can see the real behaviours of what each one of those pigments does. And so each one of those pigments behaves in a certain way. They're like different people. You know, like some people are really like, they're full on, you know, like...
Oh, yeah, Natalie. I know one of those.
So... I would call those really, and it's not their intense, as though they're like staining colours. They get in underneath and they're ingrained
in
the paper.
Blue is very like that.
Phthalocyanine blue is like that.
Oh,
but cobalt blue is not.
That's true. Yeah.
It will sit on top really gently.
Yeah.
So it was understanding those nuances of that, and that is really obvious in red. So that hue of red, because it's got such diversity and it sits across the, you know, the warm advancing colours, the cool receding palette, and then you've got the earth reds, it gave three different types of avenues that I could explore the characteristics. And each one of the, there were 25 pigments that were defined as pigment red in, and I just did all of my work on Winsor & Newton's reds because I really had to narrow the work down. Yeah, so even within 25, there's an extraordinary amount of difference. But I did it under a framework of an English colour maker called George Field.
Yeah, which that's because he talks about beauty, the measure of beauty. So tell us more about him. He sounds fascinating.
So at first when I read George Field's work and the connection with how I came to understand his works is... Oh, his writing, was that Winsor & Newton bought his recipes to start Winsor & Newton. So they had all of his recipes and notebooks. And when I started work with Winsor & Newton, they had a museum that was set up at their original Harrow factory. And I saw some of those and was fascinated by them. But I was very lucky at the time I was there, not lucky for the people that were there that going through the shift. But I happened to visit at a time when the factory was moving from London over to Le Mans in France. And by having that happen, all of those things that were George Field's writings and notebooks and all the pigments and that were placed in an archive.
Wow.
And that went into this little dingy room in Shepherd's Bush where it was held. So when I was in there looking at some pigments, because I was doing a residency there, and I used to, every year I'd go over and I'd ask if I could stay an extra 2 weeks to do some experiments with any new products that was, or new colours that were being developed. I sat down on this dusty little floor and started to look through his books and realised that there was one page that I took a photograph of, and it talked about the characteristics or the inherent qualities of pigments. And I suddenly realised that I probably was the first person in a very long time to pick up these books and actually have a good look at them. And although he'd been a colour maker who was an extraordinary person, he had lots of ideas which I really objected to, and I just thought, oh.
It's the late 1800s. Like,
Yeah. So.
So like what? Objected to
one. Oh, look, he had some really wacky, not wacky. He had some very different views, and after a while I started to realize he was probably just as obsessive compulsive as what I am.
Yeah.
He saw the world in threes.
Yeah.
Three. So the number three. He saw all these correlations. So everything he did was connected to religion. So he was very deep-seated with the Trinity. So, you know, if there was a colour palette of three, it was about the perfect triunity palette, the red, the yellow, the blue. How can I make the perfect yellow? How can I make a perfect blue? And the thing was the Arceus red. How do I make the perfect red? Because you can't have the perfect triunity if you didn't have the perfect red. He saw correlations between even structures in the body. So the eye has three parts. You know, he saw that three was really significant. And so I started to construct my PhD thesis around threes, you know, in the same, and I lived with threes.
I didn't know this. No, this is fascinating.
So now you've got two to go. Three PhDs. How interesting.
That's hilarious. You could probably find any number in anything if you really tried. But good on
you. But it was really fascinating, though. And like I said, I really resented a lot of his writing, but as I started to read all of his books, and I have read through all of them pretty much and many times over now, and a lot of it goes in one ear and out the other because that's just the type of person that I am, but it really did leave an imprint for me.
Yeah.
And it was really more, he had this beautiful poetry with the way he described colours. And he saw them as, it was the characteristics. So when he talked about beauty of colour, which is something that I really gravitated towards, he would talk about its sureness, its brightness and its depth. And to me that had been lost, like this sense of really understanding that not only did the colour I was working with on my palette had that, but also the place in which I was working also had that. And so as an artist, I had to make this correlation between this English colour palette that I had with this landscape that was really far removed from the place of Winsor & Newton colours that were on the... Like, it was like, how do you say that with that?
Yeah.
And it really, like that was like... That's my life. Like, that's who we are as artists working in Australia. You know, I had no understanding of what it was like to be in a remote area. I didn't really... I had worked in lots of areas in Central Australia on different projects, but not as an artist myself. I tapped in and I tapped back out, as many people do, but never where I really had to think... in a very considered way, how am I going to make art about this? And what does it mean if I want to make art about this? So that whole, you know, sureness, brightness, depth started to take on a different nuance for me.
And it's a real poetry to what you're saying. And I think sometimes colour can become, you know, deep conversations about colour can become quite heavy and techy and not sensitive. And I think if you you lose that poetry, which I'm feeling from you, that you're looking at colour in a very, again, I want to say feminine, but I mean, you know, like a nuanced way.
Well, I don't think it's feminine in the end, because you look at someone like George Field, who was like, really was such an egotistical man. Yeah. Like, he really was quite obnoxious. But he had this great sensitivity to it. So he just, I think it was in the end, he just saw it as the particle.
Yes.
He saw the chemistry in it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the way.
The science doesn't have to be, the sciences can be poetic.
Well, he was the sensuous chemist.
Yes. Mm. Yes.
So
how did they make red back then?
Well, he's really well renowned, and this was one of the big things with Winsor & Newton, is he Beatles. Made rose madder genuine.
Yeah.
And the rose madder was really something that he championed. It was something that Joseph Banks had a link with too. He tried unsuccessfully to create rose madder, so they had to import madder from the Europeans. And when madder is it's a plant. And the root of it is what is used to make the rose colour. And because it was that rose colour, and it's much better than alizarin crimson, it's much softer to work with, but it has properties in it that no other colour has in that cool palette. So that's why it's the Arceus red, because it allowed you to mix with the blues to make violets, but it allowed you to make these really beautiful oranges as well. But it was the colour of flesh. It was the hue in the sky. It had a very natural sense rather than it looking acidic. You know, it doesn't look acidic. And rose madder is actually a dye. So because it comes from a plant, it's actually a dye. But he created this three-tiered factory called an elaboratory, which I just loved. I'm going to create a studio called a laboratory because I just love the idea of it, and I want it to be over three floors. This is my dream place. And that, you know, that might be my next project that I'm going into, because what that plant did is there's a laking process. And for anybody who's interested in colour, they're probably well aware of all of this. But it's a laking pigment. So it's basically a dye that's made to believe that it's a pigment. So it's still a colour that will fade. So it's a little, it's moderately durable. But given the right conditions, it's a lot more resilient than any dye would be, because it's attached to an alum base. The beauty of that colour, and I'm using that colour in one of my installations at the exhibition, because I love it. It just looks really quite beautiful. But you won't see it. There's that colour and one other potter's pink, which will be in one of the glass cylinders. And really after the first day, it will be lucky if you can see the colour in the tube. The tube will actually go clear. And so this installation is going to show the characteristics of those pigments, because they have a weight to them. So every particle has a weight that you have to consider.
Yeah. I've heard, do you know the artist Amy Schumer?
No.
That's the actress, Amy Silman.
Sorry. There you go. Thank you. This is
why I don't know them. I could have said yes then.
Amy Schumer painted. That's incredible.
I hate the menopause. I said it with such certainty. Amy Silman, is it? Yes. She's done an amazing lecture on colour where she stands with this tube of cadmium red. And she talks about the weight of paint and the, you know, the materials you two would get on.
Yeah.
I could see you having great chats.
There are a lot of colour nerds.
Yeah.
So I went to an international colour conference last November in, where was I? Chiang Rai in Thailand.
Oh, I've been there.
And I presented The Nature of Redness. And it was really quite extraordinary because first of all, you've got people from all around the world that are just obsessed with colours, but they might be engineers, architects, designers.
How fascinating.
And my conversations about the personalities of colours was something that really resonated, that people were fascinated about. But, by doing the work that I've done to date, you find other colour nerds around the world.
Yeah.
Like we do, like, I actually have a little WhatsApp group called the Chroma Crowd.
I love it.
And we all exchange, you know, artwork that we might be doing or different trajectories that we're looking at. one of the things I very consciously decided, and my the way I found my workout at Mungo, it probably needs me to say how I got there in the first place.
Yes, I was going to say, because let's wind back, because the work that you're going to be exhibiting has a long... It's been a long and winding path of discovery.
It's like 10 years' work.
Yeah. And so winding back, you first were interested in the Mungo woman and man, is that correct? And the pigment that was found.
I actually started the research looking at fluorescent red pigments.
Okay.
And I was on a project, funny enough, with Pete Sharp.
Yeah.
And we were at it was a project with Melbourne University called Insight Radical Project. I was working for Winsor & Newton. It was with JASCO. So JASCO is an Australian materials distributor here.
Yep.
And Winsor & Newton is one of the brands. There was something like 60 brands that I was working across, but Winsor & Newton was the main one that I spent most of my time with. But Insight Radical was the last of the projects, no, not the second last project that I worked on, not The Way Home that you'd mentioned before, was another one of those. I think we did five different projects. Every 2 years we would do a different project.
You must have been seen as the fairy godmother turning up with the pigment.
This one, the Insight Radical, was different because I was an artist going on this project, and it was the first time where I had trod on to the other side and did, because it was my pet project, really.
Yeah.
But this particular...
All good. Just a little alarm.
Yep. So this particular project, Insight Radical, came from a conversation with some chemists, and I'd been at a conference and it was to do with colour, and we were talking about how there were free radicals in paint. So I was really interested with paint degradation and how the films...
When you say free radical, I'm imagining some radicals inside the paint with placards.
But everybody knows what free radicals is. Yes, that's right. They always go, there's free radicals in this. So that's what it was about. It was about how cells break up, and that's what cancers are. So if you imagine that, so my project started talking about how particles can randomly go off and do something, and they are, and in the art world, that can either be a good thing or a bad thing. Yeah. So for oil paint, you need free radicals for the paint film to construct itself, for it to dry, for it to oxidize. But after a while, that oxidization process allows it also to degrade. Because
so the moisture can get in and the mould and the...
Now, I'm probably dumbing down that conversation incredibly, but... It just sparked this thing about understanding that paintings and artwork were living and breathing constantly. Yeah. And I started to understand the words of the chemists that I was speaking to in Winsor & Newton, where they were saying, and I did spend a lot of time with conservators at galleries as well, and they often talked about how oil paintings get heavier as they age because they're adding in oxygen. And it just fascinated me.
Same with glass.
Yeah. Yes.
Over hundreds of years, glass windows.
And they're heavier bottom. At the bottom. Yeah. So I just thought, look, there's a conversation in there that needs to be had. And so that had, I think there were five or six artists that we worked on that project. And I was working with fluorescence and I was doing a lot of flying. So I was really looking at light and the images of land that I was seeing from afar. So that whole mapping thing is something that I really resonate with Joe about as well. Because I was capturing these glimpses, and I remember taking a photograph of the light coming through, and I've got thousands and thousands of photographs from aeroplane windows. I became silently obsessed about them. One day there's a whole exhibition in that, I'm sure, along with the other thousands of people that have done the same thing. But there was this red light, and I was thinking about after images, you know, how you have a light that might bounce and the colour is so fluorescent you could never paint that. There's nothing that could ever represent that. And that kind of steered me down the red path. And then I knew that it had to be about red because the conversations that I'd had with one of the scientists at Melbourne University, he talked about red being this really the end of the colour spectrums, that blue was at one end and red was at the other, and that we were working on this stuff called quantum dot colour. Anyway, that was the beginning. That's how I actually started my PhD, was looking at quantum dot colours and trying to invent that, until we realised that it was going to be extremely toxic to do that. And so we just sort of shut that down. And
what is a quantum dot colour?
Oh, don't go there. Okay, it's just great. Too hard. Toxic. But it is. Yeah. I'm sure it'll find its way, but it was way too early days and it really just wasn't going to happen. But it was fluorescence and it was really quite extraordinary. Mm. But and you would have to see it under black light. So I started with playing with – I really was looking at light. But then I had the really good fortune, this beautiful friend of mine who I've spent many years working with, in different facets, Liz O'Reilly, she said to me, you know what you need to do? You need to come out to Mungo. And she hadn't been out there for a while. She'd gone and done some work out there 10 years previous. And she said, I've got a few other friends. How about we do the next project that you're going to do? Can we do it at Mungo? So there were five, originally there were six artists. We all had a very similar sentiment about how we wanted to approach this original residency. And we all did our mad research on what Mungo was, because we wanted to know what it was, and I didn't want to go to a place that I didn't understand. So I read all these, I suppose they were all archaeological papers, and one of them had the name of an archaeologist on it, and I thought, gee, that name's familiar. I think I taught with that person at a school. It was St. Catherine's at Waverley. So I Googled him and found out that he, through LinkedIn, that he was working at Griffith University, and sent a message saying, you know, I'm really interested in doing a project at Mungo, and I understand that, you know, I've got to go and speak to the community that's there. Do you know anybody that you can let me know of who I should ask for permission? We're trying to put this proposal together, because it's a World Heritage Area for a start. It's New South Wales National Parks and Wildlife Service. They run the park. Anyway, I did submit the proposal, and I was only there for, I think, 2.5 days. It was really quite drought-stricken then. It was the first time that the three traditional tribal groups had come together. They were all out at Mungo at the same time. But what happened that day was kind of the precursor for me just being completely moved by the place, so that it changed who I was as a person forever. Like, it really was just that line that just went, oh, I know why I'm here now. And originally I thought that it was the story of the red ochre found on Mungo Man, and that my redness was about that. But it became about understanding who we are as in terms of life. And so on that journey out that day, we went out to a location, and that location became the place that we were provided for our residency, and it's a little bit further away from Mungo. And I was able to see the footprints that were tens of thousands of years old.
Wow.
And with the elders that were there, and it was part of them seeing the footprints before they were going to be covered again. Mm. And, like, they won't be seen again. And that was just the most extraordinary privilege to see the feet of some little child from so, so long ago, and see all those little pitter-pat feet. It was like you could see the dancing. You could hear the sounds. Like, it was extraordinary.
Yeah.
So I found it really moving. And then the next day I had to give the proposal, and I was so emotional that I was like a blubbering mess. And I embarrassed myself completely. But they were really taken back by the fact that it had moved me so emotionally being there. Mm. I was really grateful for that moment, because it really set a connection there with people that has lasted to now and will last forever.
Yeah, and you're continuing those conversations and explorations, and again, through osmosis, these things are being passed on. And I think
you learn that you've got to learn.
Yes, you've got to learn, you've got to listen.
Yeah, well, the first thing I learnt was that I had to shut up.
Mm.
And for those people that know me, they know that that's really hard. Yeah. Like the Greek in me is just like we talk over the top of each other all the time.
Listening though, right?
Yeah.
That deep listening.
Yeah. Yeah, and just being in places, like walking. I did a lot of walking with people. Yeah. And so most of the time when I was out there, I didn't make a lot of art. I did a lot of writing and I just walked. And a few times I'd do sketches, and at the exhibition I've got, I very purposefully, and I hope that they get to stay on the wall, I've included three small sketches that I did on site because it's very rare that I would do a work on site there. I just felt like it was wrong for some reason to do it in the places where I was. And I had these great visions that I was going to do, have the glass cylinders and show that in situ and all of that. And I was like, it just feels wrong. And that just feels wrong. And
how does the red ochre in from the earth out there like act differently to say like a Winsor and Newton pigment?
There is no red ochre. That was the thing, is that that red ochre on that man had travelled from many, many miles away. That's why it's so extraordinary, is that for them to have chosen at that point when he died to use that red meant that he was special, that person. Mm. And that red was so extraordinary because it had been travelled from one place to another. So there was, to me, there was agency in that red that was there. And it was like, okay, well, what's in that? How do I now? And you'll know, if you go to the exhibition, you'll see that I call the observations Golgol layer colour observations.
Yeah.
And Golgol layer is a layer that sits at the Mungo lunettes, and it's the red layer. It's the oldest layer of the lunettes. And although it's disputed now, and Dan's corrected me many times, that they actually think that they've found an organism in it. But at the time when I first started and I was looking at this first inquiry, it was like the demarcation layer of life. And so I was like, okay, this red layer, and I can see it. And there was only one time that I've seen it, and there was this circle that was carved, and I've got a picture of it. My son took the photo because he came out, and he took a photo of me, and I'm sitting on the Golgol layer, and it's this deep, dark layer, and the light was going down as well, so the red was shifting. But it's like, okay, what colour do I have in my palette, or how can I make the colour of red that is the demarcation of life, where there's no living organism that sits here? You know, what is that red? And that started it.
Did you make it?
I did.
Hang on.
You're leaving us hanging.
I haven't answered the question. No. Like, I really haven't answered the question because it continues.
Do you need to make that red?
Yeah. Maybe you don't need to make it. Maybe just knowing it's there is enough.
It really is about, so the work that I've got in there now, I'm actually looking at that more closely. So I'm layering the reds. And so you have a sense of that. It's a little bit like the rust that Joe's been dealing with too, yeah. Is that there is no such thing as one redness. Like, that's why it's redness, because it's a state of being. Otherwise I would call it nature of red.
Yeah. And colours do evolve, don't they, I guess?
It's and they change constantly because it's the light. So the photograph that was taken for and George Field, to go back to George Field, good old George, even though he's where he is in Herefordshire, you know, making colours, he still has this sense of looking at light because they were the romantics, yeah. You know, they were looking at the world with these, you know, and inventing things. And he's looking at that shift of light where you can, and he called it Pernke shift, I think that's how it's pronounced, but it's where light is fading so much that you can no longer see red in the spectrum. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that's really extraordinary, that. Yeah. And I've seen that so many times. You see it at the very beginning of the day and you see it right at the very end of the day.
You know, like, birds can see way more hues than humans. I often wonder, do you think other humans can see more hues than you can?
Definitely.
Or different. Like, everyone can different see hues. Different yep. colours. Right. Like,
yep.
You know, you might see a red completely different than I see a red because my eye might work differently than yours.
I mean, I'm looking at that white wall behind you, and for me, I see a flutter of colour straight away.
Yeah. Because it's all the reflected or refracted, I'd never get that right, colour, isn't it? And like you were saying, so a colour's only a colour when it's placed next to another colour, isn't it? And
in context.
Yeah, everything's in context.
Well, and everything's flipped in your eyes too.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, isn't it? The sky is like a bluey purple, but we only see it as blue, stuff like that. Like the actual colour of the spectrum we don't see.
Look, that takes, that's one of my unanswered questions in my thesis, where
that
whole blueness and whether, because I look at the so when I decided I was going to do red, the first thing I got questioned by very dear friend, Tanya Charles, was like, why are you doing red? That's men's colour.
Really?
Wow. And the yellow
And the yellow is women's colour.
Oh, I don't think colours is gender at all.
No, I don't see
colour
as
gender.
Yeah,
but it is for Aboriginal people.
Ah, right, so beg your pardon.
Oh, I see.
So I was doing a colour and she kept questioning why
isn't
I would be doing that. But nevertheless, she entertained the fact that I was doing it, and she knew I was, like, she's, Tanya has walked many, many times across, and she's the one that I really... have heard so many stories, and there's many other people that have shared their stories too, but Tanya is one that I've spent a lot of time with, walking out at Mungo with, and she spent a lot of time with my children as well. But right at the very end, because every time I would make something or I'd write something, I would go back and sit down, we'd have a meal and we'd read through it, or I'd read a chapter. And I'd ask whether I, you know, I wanted to ask permission and make sure that it was okay. And every year, not every year, but every time that the Aboriginal Advisory Group would meet, I would present what I'd been doing so that they were giving permission. And they signed off on my thesis at the end and the artwork. Because that process was really important to me. But, yeah, she got to the end and she looked at this work that I'd been, you know, labouring over, and I'd taken it out there. Every journey I took it out, and I didn't do anything to it. I just took it out, what I'd done on it, and it's still in my studio and it still looks like shit, but it's still red. Yeah. Like, it's this saturation of red. It just needs more time, which is what all my work is about. But she just said, your work is blood. Like, your work is blood. And that was really confronting for me, because my first time I went and stayed out with the group of artists when we did the residency, it had been this long drought where the earth was really red out there. There were big red kangaroos, like everything felt like it was red. Mm. And then when we did the residency, we had this massive downpour and we got flooded in, and we were out there for a month and it just poured and poured and poured, so we were trapped out there. Weirdly enough, I ended up with a bloody nose that it ran and ran for weeks until they had to do an emergency evacuation, and I was taken to hospital because I'd lost so much blood. There was just blood everywhere.
Wow.
So she had probably long forgotten about that, but there was all these connections with that. I went back out to the, like, I saw the residency out. It was perfectly fine. It was probably, I don't know, it's the sinus that it's hereditary in the Greek family. but it definitely was a sign. When I returned, my husband was diagnosed with lymphoma, a blood cancer. Mm. And that sat underneath all of the work that I was doing. And I never realised that till I got right at the end, that it was really about looking at the small particles. And it took me back to the stuff that I did at the beginning, where you look at the smallest things in life and how every little molecule counts.
Yeah.
You know, everything has another impact on another thing again.
It does.
So your work really ties together, I think, when you when you explain it like that. There's a lot of correlation between looking at the small things that explain the big things, and that's
so exciting. And look, you could go into the exhibition and you'll just see red and you'll just go, wow, red. You know, you won't, like, none of those stories or those personal narratives are evident in it.
In it, no. And you just see it for what it is.
Yeah, because you're just living life.
Red things for birthdays and Christmas?
Yeah, surely, and my birthday is 14th of July, so it's either they buy Bastille and French things all the time, and now they've moved on to red things. Yeah.
You'll have to change your colour. You'll be...
Yeah, the other one. Going or you're going to have to be yellow.
Another 10 years on yellow. Blue. Natalie, this could be interesting.
I have worked with blue quite a lot before that. I actually did work on a series where it was blue and redness together to create blackness. So depending on what the red was or the blue, you could get the density of blacks, which for all the traditional painters, they would have done that as well. They'd be aware of that.
Yeah. Mix. Well, I think burnt sienna or burnt umber and ultramarine blue, that makes a nice dark.
Yeah. And I always wondered about, like, Winsor & Newton had that Viridian green, and I just think, oh, what a horrible green is that to work with. Like, I really couldn't get my head around it because it just wasn't the green that we would be, like you mentioned sap green before. Yeah. Well, Viridian green is like, oh, what would you do with that?
It's very European though, isn't it?
Well, I thought so. And then I realised that when they put them in those sets, that alizarin crimson and the Viridian green makes these beautiful blacks but extraordinary greys to work with. Yes. So that magic, like sometimes you don't realise that it's the combinations of things together that create the magic.
I love playing mixing. Just you could just sit for hours just mixing.
I don't know enough about all the pigments and the properties of all the different paints, but it is fascinating. And I think it's really great for artists to understand all that. It gives you a lot of nuance in your work when you understand what colour can bring something out or not. It just takes time to understand it all when you're using it. But, it's fascinating.
What I've been doing in my work at the moment, working with students that come through, is just to keep emphasising to them the need to know. You know, if you're going to use a graphite pencil, know exactly what graphene, you know, like, what is graphite? And know it to the nth degree. And I really do think there's an obligation for painters to really get to know. Like, if they are going to use potter's pink, you know that it's a semi-transparent, know that it has a weight or a softness and what it's going to do with that yellow or with that. Like, otherwise, what you do is you just keep replicating the same stuff again.
And I feel like I know, you know, you do the colour wheel and the colour mixing, but I find it extremely
colour wheels are banned
boring.
In my classes. Yeah.
So boring. I find them, like, colour not theory. Helpful. But I think knowing about the pigments and whatnot is far more helpful.
Yeah.
And knowing, like you said, it's a soft, it's transparent, all that. Although when you look on the tube, there is a lot of information on the tube.
There's
that you
heaps.
Can get
there
from
is heaps.
It, but,
and the transparency.
My lectures were all based on actually just holding the tube up and just basically looking
reading
at
it.
Like
yeah.
all the cues are there. It's and just all, understanding what the cues are. It's like a cereal box.
Even in... in terms of, we had a long discussion this week in printmaking about black, because, and it's quite good in printmaking because everyone's quite nerdy about it, and we literally went on for about an hour about the different properties of black and the warm black and the cool black and the you know, the opacity, and some of the young ones were like, what? I was like, catch up.
Well, all those things about opacity, transparency, these were all the language that George Field had instigated. So all of that, his characteristics, all those inherent qualities of pigments, is what's on the tubes that we have today.
Yeah.
And that's why he's so extraordinary.
Good old George. What a ledge.
Well thank ladies. You, ladies. That was fascinating.
I can't wait to go and see the work now.
I know. I think
everyone else who listens to the podcast, you will be able to go see the work and really feel moved, because I think that you need sometimes, not always, but it's important to have an understanding of the intention of the work as well as viewing the work.
Well thank you to both
of you for giving context to our work, because sometimes you just walk into the gallery and go, well, what's that about?
But the work is the work, isn't it?
It is the work, and it is whatever it does
but
to
I
people.
Do always find when you've listened to a video or something, it really brings the work to life when you hear about it. You know, you can walk into a gallery and see it, but when you hear the story behind it and the why, everything comes
richer.
Out of it.
It's richer.
I mean, yeah, your work to me is 10 times richer because we've got one of Joe's paintings / textiles behind us, and just you explaining it, I'm like, oh, you know, it unlocks a lot of stuff.
Exactly.
Which is great.
And I think on the last weekend, it's the, what is it, the 13th of April?
Oh, yes.
We've got the Colour Society. So if anybody wants to join the Australian Colour Society.
Is that a cult or?
No, this is all my nerdy colour friends.
I love it. Are they colourful in their dress?
Not always.
But they wear black.
Yeah.
Or white. It's a cool
but
black.
I'm not sure if it's the president, but David Briggs, who's at National Arts
yes.
School and runs the Colour
Society. Yes.
He runs the Colour Society.
Oh,
so he's asked us to do a talk at the Wallara Gallery that day, and it's opened up to not only the Colour Society but the general public to come.
Fantastic.
Come
to
that. Fantastic.
Do people have to book for that, or is it just
yes.
a pitch?
Yes, yes, and it'll be through, I think the Colour Society are going to do it, but the Wallara will be able to.
Okay, we'll put a link okay. so you
I didn't
can.
Even know there was a Colour Society. I'm going to Google that.
Oh, like there's an international Colour Society.
Oh,
they're
I'm
all
sure.
connected. Like it's a really active, wow. Very committed group of people.
Good on them.
I love it.
Should
the Chroma Crowd.
The Chroma Crowd.
The Chroma that. Crowd. That is cool. That you need a t-shirt. Oh,
yeah.
The Chroma Crowd.
Well, thank you, Natalie. Thank you, Joe. And thank you for that beautiful cake.
And thank you for that cake, which I have inhaled.
Yes, I did too, before we even started. Thank you very much, ladies. Go.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to share, rate and review. It all helps my mum Julie and Fiona get more listeners. Thank you.